Well, thank you. Like I said, I have to stay near the mic today. Thank you, Corrine and Paul and Ryan, also the governing the board of the Meter Center, for the invitation to give this talk today. I should also thank the Meter Center secondarily for, you know, I was able to take part in the NEH seminar, I guess that was 3 years back, where we specifically investigated the broader sort of social history of Calvinism in early modern Europe. And so that certainly had an impact on my thinking. And then I've continued to do research, some of it here in the Meter Center. And sort of the fruit of that I'll be bringing to you today. Of course, it's not that easy to condense, to reduce, 120 pages of text into an hour-and-a-half lecture, right? Oh, excuse me, more like a 45-minute lecture. But anyway, I'll do my best. And when I was thinking about how to do this, it occurred to me that the story of the Heidelberg Reformation in some ways is not, that different than perhaps other stories you have heard before. A group of talented young people come together after, kind of years of apprenticeships and other contexts. They're able to, they work together and they score a major triumph, a hit, as it were. In this case, most of you would know that the hit, of course, is the Heidelberg Catechism. But then after that, through creative differences, they fall out with one another. And then, of course, there's the final kind of climax. Some of the people fall by the wayside and, are tragically lost along the way. Others go on to new triumphs, new achievements in other contexts. So anyway, that's the approach that I'm going to try to take today to try to enliven this a little bit. Maybe, am I too close to the mic? Okay, too close to the mic. German Calvinism in Crisis, the story kind of behind the catechism, you might say, or perhaps the story of the Heidelberg Reformation that you didn't learn in the catechism class, of course. But this is the story after 1563. And I should say here, it's perhaps implicit with this approach that I'm attempting a mildly revisionistic account of the Heidelberg Reformation. This was the defining moment in the history of Reformed Protestantism, or this was a defining moment in the history of Reformed Protestantism. Only here, in fact, did the Reform movement in the Palatinate take on a decisively Calvinistic flavor, in some measure breaking with the early Melanchthonian or Zwinglian streams. The triumph of the Calvinist vision of church discipline over that of Zurich and Heidelberg signaled the increasing domination of the Geneva paradigm over the earlier Zwinglian Upper German patterns of reform within the larger international reformed movement. So that's where we're going. But before we get to the disciplinary controversy per se, we'll pick up the story just with a little background information about the Palatinate there in Germany. Of course, we in our Wayback Machine, and we travel to Germany in the 16th century. Of course, there wasn't a Germany in the 16th century. There was the Holy Roman Empire. And the Palatinate, as we'll see here, was, of course, known as the Kurpfalz or the Electoral Palatinate in the early modern period, territory along the Rhine River, around the Neckar River. I saw a lot of you guys looking at the picture when you came in. I think probably the majority of people here have already been to Heidelberg once. You visited the castle. You've kind of lived the student prince experience. A number of you, I think, have already been there. Okay, the Electoral Palatinate, of course, it was one of the seven premier principalities of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's to say the prince of the Palatinate was an elector. He had the right to take part in the imperial elections. So it was a very prominent principality, and so when it went reformed in 1563 or in the early 1560s, it was a big deal in the history of the Reformation, and of course also a hugely important in the history of the Reformed Protestant movement. And of course, the setting for our story today is the city of Heidelberg itself. There we see Heidelberg along the Neckar River. If any of you guys have been to Heidelberg, you perhaps would have taken the hike up on the Philosopher's Path, the Philosopher's Way, across the river from Heidelberg, and that, of course, is the view that you would still have today onto the old city with the castle above. And of course, why, you know, Heidelberg, it is a very romantic town. I lost my heart in Heidelberg. That's what I actually had already lost my heart before I came to Heidelberg, but that's another story. We don't want to go there, I guess. But of course, it's primarily important in German history, German cultural history, as a university center. And of course, it's actually what 1386, the first university that's founded in the current boundaries of Germany. Okay, that. A lot of qualifications there, is in Heidelberg. And, of course, it was a major intellectual center, had been a major center of the Renaissance in Germany, but early on did not play a particularly significant role in the Reformation. And we'll quickly review that here. Just to look at the Reformation there in the Palatinate. So in the first phase, in the 1520s and the 1530s, there was no break with the Catholic Church in the Palatinate. However, Protestant ideas were very popular there, and there were a number of prominent Protestant pastors and academics who had positions at the University of Heidelberg. So, in a sense, Protestant ideas weren't suppressed, but the principality did not openly embrace the Reformation. And then we move into kind of to the second phase. After one kind of halting attempt in the 1540s and then definitively in the 1550s, the Palatinate, with the territory with Heidelberg, with its capital, did become Lutheran. Okay, and then of course the phase which we would be more interested in and more familiar with, in the early 1560s, we have the coming of the Second Reformation to the Palatinate. The Palatinate moves into the Reformed camp, and of course this was due to the decision. Of course, it's after 1555. The prince has the right to establish the religion of his territory, and the prince at this time, of course, was Elector Frederick the Pious, and he's the one who gradually adopts a reformed view of the Lord's Supper and then begins to implement those changes in the worship there in Heidelberg, and then gradually consolidate the Reformation there in Heidelberg. Well, the people who made this happen, I'm sure you've probably heard a lot of these people before. A key person there who perhaps we wouldn't have heard as much about in our catechism class was Thomas Erastus. Thomas Erastus was a medical professor at the university. He becomes a member of the church council. He's an important lay theologian. He writes a couple important treatises advocating the Reformed view of the Lord's Supper and also Reformed Eucharistic practice. So he has a very important impact really there in the early 1560s. He also recruits some of the later Reformed theologians to come teach there at the University of Heidelberg. So Erastus was kind of a key schemer, you might say, in bringing about the transformation to the Reformed confession in the Palatinate. The next guy I'm sure you have heard of, Caspar Olivianus, a little younger than Erastus, and he arrived a little later than Erastus. Actually someone with a legal education originally, but who had studied theology, spent a little time in Zurich and in Geneva, probably in Lausanne as well. And he comes in, and he's briefly a professor of theology at the university, but then his primary role really is as an organizer of the Palatine Church. And then he becomes a church superintendent, a member of the church council, and plays a leading role within the church itself, but not really within the university. And as we see later on, the university and the church sometimes will really be at loggerheads with one another. And then, of course, really probably the most famous person from a theological perspective from the Heidelberg Reformation is Zacharias Ursinus, whichever you prefer, the young Silesian, former student of Melanchthon, who comes there. And he's, pretty, clearly the theological brain trust, you might say, of the organization. He's the person who has been recognized really as the lead author of the Heidelberg Catechism. Olivianus, Erastus, Boquin, other people probably had something to do with it as well. But Ursinus was probably the lead author of the Catechism. But he's also, think of him in some ways as kind of the melancholy genius of the group. In time, he really soured on the public controversies. He was a little bit of a quirky personality, someone who was kind of inclined to withdraw a little bit from the scene. So he didn't have as decisive an impact on some of the controversies that come along originally. In fact, and of course, the basic storyline here in some ways is that early on, Erastus and Olivianus get along quite well with one another, and particularly Olivianus really has a very kind of respectful kind of admiration for Erastus and an appreciation for his talents. But in time, as we move forward, Erastus is someone represents kind of the tradition of Zurich and the Zwinglian Reformation. Olivianus really represents the tradition of Geneva. He's really, as Lyle Bierman has written, probably the leading sort of Calvinist, distinctly Calvinist theologian working in Germany at this point in time. So in time, they really become bitter rivals, and then it becomes an outright feud over time. So we'll move on. We'll see more of that as we move on. So when we come to 1563, 1564, we have the consolidation of the Reformation in Heidelberg. And with that, we have the Heidelberg Catechism, which we've mentioned before, and then a couple other important documents from that period as well. One is the Church Order from 1563, which kind of establishes the structures there of the Church, and then also the Church Council Order, which kind of regulates how the Church is going to interact with the state. And as you see there, I have on the overhead Calvinist. The general consensus at this point in time is that the Palatine Church was not distinctly Calvinist at this point in time, but Melanchthonian streams, influences had flown in, as well as influences from Zurich. And so there was really quite a successful kind of blend of the earlier traditions of the Reformation in Heidelberg, that they created something that was distinctly Heidelberg as opposed to being a slavish imitation of another city. However, there was a huge unresolved issue that was going to obviously cause a lot of trouble down the road in the Palatine Reformation, and that issue was the question of church discipline. In an ideally reformed community, how are we going to go about disciplining the members of the church? And there really were two models that to compete with one another at the time. And, of course, we may be more familiar with the Geneva model of church discipline, which would have a consistory, which would be a joint lay ecclesiastic body to monitor morals within the Christian community, as opposed to the Zurich model of church discipline. In Zurich there, once the Reformation had occurred, they created this institution known as the marriage court. And this was kind of fundamentally a secular institution, and they left this kind of this institution under state control really handle moral offenses. They didn't erect a separate ecclesiastical body to handle these things. And seeing this a little bit, they had two competing traditions, you might say, within the Reformed community. The Geneva model, you might say, tended largely to be justified on the basis of New Testament precedents. Matthew 18 passage, for example. And also in the Geneva model, the roles of church and state were fairly clearly delineated. Okay, that it was thought that church and state should in some senses be separate from one another, but hopefully they would cooperate with one another. Whereas in Zurich, they tended to justify their system more on Old Testament precedents. Back in the days of King David, they really didn't need to have a separate clerical body to control morals. So they had this, what was some scholars refer to as a single sphere theory, that there really needs to be no division of church and state in a Christian society. If the magistrate is Christian, that's good enough, and we can trust these things to the Christian magistrate, and that's the way God willed it, based on kind of the theocratic principles of the Old Testament. And then kind of looking on, what is the impact of this on the ground? In Geneva, we have very active use of excommunication, or actually more properly said, of suspension from the sacrament. Okay, well, like 1 in 15, I think, Monter or Kingdon has written, up to like over 600 a year, perhaps, I think, the high point of it. The high point comes around 1570, whereas in Zurich and some of the Swiss-German territories, excommunication is rare. It's basically a dead issue, right? Once again, it's more or less the state is going to control those things. And we have down on the bottom there the later Calvinists. Some Calvinists even went further than this, saying, well, not only is this a good idea, this is really the way God meant it to be. I mean, this is sort of church discipline by divine right. This is, you know, if we're going to follow God, God's law, God's principles in the New Testament properly, we're going to institute this. And church discipline, along with preaching the word and administering the sacraments, is one of the marks of a true church, one of the notae ecclesia. Okay? So that's obviously the big unresolved issue there in Heidelberg. We have some people like Thomas Erastus who are pretty content with the kind of the status quo, which was kind of mandating excommunication in theory in Heidelberg, but in practice pretty much allowing the state to take care of those things. And then we have people like Caspar Olivianus who really think that, hey, the church is only really half reformed. And in fact, Calvin had written Olivianus in 1562, around the time of their writing the Catechism. Calvin had written Olivianus and saying, you know, you really need to work on discipline, you kind of sooner now than later, but it's really tough in a place where you have a Christian prince. Okay, so Calvin had foreseen the difficulty, and one of the few direct occasions where Calvin actually had something to say about the Reformation and the Palatinate there. But before we get to the controversy over church discipline, which briefly we'll note, in the mid 1560s, the leaders of the Palatine Church and the Palatine State, they really had too much kind of on their plate to really worry about moving in the direction of a more proactive disciplinary regime. Once again, the Heidelberg Catechism had, in theory, violated the terms of the Peace of Augsburg. Right? The Peace of Augsburg in 1555 had given the territories of the Holy Roman Empire, the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire, two options. Right? If you can be, the ruler has the right to determine the religion. But you have two choices: you can be Catholic, or you can be Lutheran, or you can adhere to the Augsburg Confession. Okay, and then so the Heidelberg Catechism comes along, and the Emperor Maximilian and a lot of the Lutheran princes cry foul. They say, what are you doing? You know, that's an obvious violation of the Peace of Augsburg. So there was an attempt to exclude the Palatinate, to exclude the Elector Frederick from the religious peace. And then that came to a head at the Peace of Augsburg. I mean, excuse me, not the Peace of Augsburg, but the Diet of Augsburg, another Diet of Augsburg in 1566. The effort to exclude the Palatinate failed. Partly because the kind of the persuasive qualities of the prince himself, who defended his confession, who argued that it was in agreement with the Augsburg Confession, properly understood. That's a whole other story there, I guess. And he also said, you know, and I haven't even read a word of that guy Calvin. I don't know what you're talking Calvinism. What's that? Okay, so that was part of his defense as well. This is only biblical. This isn't really about Calvin. Okay, then before we're just about on the brink of the controversy itself, we do have some kind of changes in personnel right before the controversy erupts in 1568. Someone who'd been there before but plays a more prominent role in the period of the church disciplinary controversy is Petrus Dathenus, or a Hollander, Peter Dathen, who was there with part of the Dutch exile community, and then takes on a leading role at court as a court preacher. And so he's one of the chief advocates of adopting a Calvinist vision of church discipline. Then Ursinus, he stays around, but he kind of withdraws a little bit from a more active role at this point in time. He resigns his position at the university, and he teaches at the College of Wisdom, which is kind of a seminary there in Heidelberg. And he has really no direct connection with the court, so he's a little bit isolated there. And then he's replaced by the famous Italian theologian Zanchi, who had been a pupil of Peter Martyr. Moving on here, another thing just to note before we get to the controversy per se is that, you know, this was a very tumultuous time in the period of international Calvinism, right? And of course, you know, as they're about to kind of, you know, attack each other and kind of go to blows over the question of church discipline in the Palatinate, it's also the period of the French Wars of Religion and also of the Dutch Revolt in the Netherlands. And here we have the Palatinate, which is really one of the strongest, although it's a small principality itself, it is probably the strongest Reformed state on the continent that has the potential with its close location both to the Netherlands and to France to intervene militarily in those two countries. And, in fact, that happens often in this period. And there we see the Prince Johann Casimir. He was one of the younger sons of the Elector Frederick, and he is engaged in a number of military campaigns in France and then later on in the Netherlands. So that's in the background as well as we move to the controversy itself. Now we come to the controversy per se. The controversy over church discipline there in the Palatinate erupted in 1568 when a foreign student, George Withers, obviously he's a Puritan there, he'd left England as a result of the controversy over church vestments, comes to the Palatinate. Originally, he thinks, well, I'll pick up a PhD, and maybe I guess I'll cause a little trouble while I'm here. They said, no, you can't defend theses on church vestments. That would be far too inflammatory, back in England. And he said, okay, well, I'll defend theses on church discipline in the Palatinate. And, of course, he asserted in some of his theses, we don't have the whole theses, that church discipline was a mark of the true church, and also that the consistory/presbytery ought to have the power to even excommunicate the prince. Okay, and so these were pretty controversial statements there, and so with this, in a sense, there had been all this kind of latent tension in the Palatinate prior to this point in time, anyway, and so the lid really comes off at this point in time, and so into the fall of 1568, we have this this most heated public stage of the Heidelberg church disciplinary controversy. And as we'll see, Heidelberg really becomes, very intensely split down the middle by people who were formerly allies, the people who had really kind of brought about the Reformed movement in the Palatinate. And, of course, the disciplinists, they're the people who want church discipline, who want to move toward a more of a Calvinist vision of church discipline. Some of the key theologians and politicians/courtiers were in this camp. Dathanus, who we mentioned before, Olivianus, they were really kind of the leaders. And then another figure we won't talk much about, Wenzel Zuleger, one of the statesmen there in the Palatinate, was a key advocate of church discipline. And, of course, that's a little redundant. These people were genuine Calvinists, okay? So the genuine Calvinist faction really wanted to move in that direction. There we see Olivianus himself. Another critical influence on the development there in the Palatinate was the presence of foreign exile communities from the Low Countries. And you know what I mean by that, of course. And the Hollanders, right, or Netherlanders had a big impact on the Palatinate at this point in time. And there was a Dutch immigrant exile community in Frankenthal, and then there was a Walloon immigrant community in Schonau. And they both, in a sense, really provided an example in the midst of the Palatinate of how this could work, okay? And that was a very powerful influence. The elector eventually was kind of won over to this position, so the disciplinists seemed to have kind of an inside track with the elector. And then they also received support from abroad, okay, particularly from Theodore Beza, okay? Now, Some previous accounts actually kind of see Beza as kind of pushing this on the Palatinate. That's not the way I see it. I really think that Dathanus and Olivianus really wanted this themselves, and then in some ways Beza gets drawn in when the Genevan opinion or the Genevan practice is maligned in Heidelberg. But he's clearly the chief foreign support for the Heidelberg Calvinist. Of course, Calvin himself has passed at this point in time. And then, of course, the disciplinist faction was then faced by an anti-disciplinist faction, probably the larger group by far. The princes, descendants of Frederick, and most of the courtiers seem to have been in this anti-disciplinist group. A lot of the key politicians, probably most of the statesmen, most of the members of the upper council, including the very powerful chancellor, Christoph Probe, are generally reckoned to have been in the anti-disciplinist faction. The most famous of the anti-disciplinists, of course, was Thomas Erastus himself. And And seemingly most of the non-theological faculty of the university, the medical faculty and the arts faculty, it's not as clear with the lawyers anyway. But, of course, Thomas Erastus was kind of the key figure there. A group I would label kind of the outsider clerics. Okay, there's some popular clerics in Heidelberg, but the people who really weren't, you know, they didn't have the inside track, they didn't have the elector's ear. People like Adam Neuser, Johann Silvan, who we'll hear more about, and then a popular court preacher who, in some ways, his influence had been supplanted by Dathenus Willing, were also in this anti-disciplinist group. And, of course, most of the people whose sort of theological background hadn't been on the Calvinist side, but, you know, the Philippists, that's to say the people with trained in German universities, closely associated with Philip Melanchthon, and Zwinglians, or at least our one token Zwinglian in the person of Erastus there. Okay, and then, of course, their foreign support, they had, sort of equally prestigious foreign support. The other mother church of the Reform movement, Zurich, was solidly behind the anti-disciplinists. And so they enjoyed the support of Heinrich Bullinger, and then also of Heinrich Bullinger's successor, Rudolf Gewalter. Okay, and of course, if you were here last year for our Medio Campi's lecture, you would have heard quite a bit about that. This was a big deal, not only in Heidelberg, but it was a big deal in the relations. You can quote me on that. That is an elegant terms between the relations between Zurich and Geneva at the time. Okay, well, the conflict then raged. Into 1569, into 1570, even though, as we'll see, there really was an effort to kind of put a lid back on it. There were, various opinions. There were treatises which were written on church discipline, advocating church discipline by Zanke, Boken, and Beza, and then treatises, obviously, which were written against church discipline by Erastus, by Johann Silvan, and then Bullinger also kind of weighs in, writes a couple letters to the elector, trying to get him, not to move in that direction. The elector tried to, in a sense, quiet the situation there in the Palatinate. There was an electoral silence order there in 1568, okay, and also an attempt, and of course it was this kind of selective, you might say, well, now that the medical professors aren't really helping us out very much, maybe we should not have the arts faculty and the medical faculty really take part in theological disputations, right? Okay, we'll let the theologians themselves handle that. So the conflict raged. There was one person, though, who really stood kind of between the groups, who really, in a sense, tried to mediate between the groups. And, of course, that's kind of our hero once again, Zacharias Ursinus. And he, in some ways, he disagreed really with both parties. And really on the, just really kind of right on the eve of the church disciplinary conflict, he wrote a very angry memo to the elector in which he, he lamented the situation there in the Palatinate. And I read this to warm the hearts of the progressive wing of the Calvin History Department here. You'll see this. The church is torn, discordant, dreaming of a not yet ripe discipline, and in this time is more concerned with war than with peace, offending many good people by this curiosity and by neglect of their office and vocation. We involve them more in foreign perils than in the things of Christ. They are always sounding the bugle call when it is their duty to fight with prayers and martyrdom, not in arms. Okay, so he was really agitated at this point in time, but of course it wasn't just at, he connected very tightly this kind of the disciplinist drive toward church discipline with the kind of the foreign interventionist politics that they also represented. The two groups were kind of, were basically one and the same. However, on the question of church discipline, he did perhaps in the end maybe side a little bit more with the disciplinists than he did with the anti-disciplinists. He wrote a brief judgment on ecclesiastical discipline and excommunication that most commentators have assessed as coming down between the two camps. And though he rejected Erastus's outright repudiation of excommunication, Olivianus did clearly see church discipline. He clearly did not see church discipline as the panacea that his Calvinist colleagues did. Unlike Erastus and the Zurich theologians, however, he did think that the church had a role to play in discipline, which could be exercised along the consistory model. He did not think that this body should be independent of state control, however, and also thought that excommunication itself should be extremely rare. In short, Ursinus considered church discipline to be quite biblical in theory, but that its implementation should be restricted only to the most exceptional cases. Okay, so Ursinus kind of comes in and tries to mediate between the parties and is not really a member of either faction. Now we'll move on to kind of to the resolution of the faction. Before we get to the resolution itself, there is kind of an entertaining episode here in which one of the 16th century's most famous academics, I don't know, what you think of him like Jacques Derrida comes to town. Does that resonate with anybody? And wants a job, okay. And so the Heidelberg is already kind of torn over the question of church discipline, and all the disciplinists basically want to hire him and give him a job on the university. And the anti-disciplinists are like, you crazy? This guy, you know, this guy's he's a tremendous iconoclast. We don't want him here. This will ruin our reputation among the German university. So he does not stay. That was a brief excursus. But anyway, the note there is that his reception is completely predetermined by the existing conflicts there in Heidelberg. And now we come to the kind of the resolution of the conflict there, a key event that's going to trigger the resolution of the conflict, and it comes about with a trip to see the elephants, you might say. There was a young pastor working in the Palatinate, Matthias Vahey. A couple of his friends says, you know, we're going to travel just a few miles down the road to Speyer to visit the Imperial Reichstag, this time being held in Speyer. And the rumor is that they have some exotic elephants there. So let's go see the elephants. So he bought into this. I'll go see the elephants. What he didn't realize was that the people he was traveling with were kind of suspect, right? The people he was traveling with, so it's a trip to see the elephants or anti-Trinitarianism uncovered. The two people he were traveling with were they were members of the anti-disciplinist faction, who in this they're kind of going overboard, you might say, kind of in their critique of the church. They began to examine a few other things as well. In fact, it happened that they happened to become anti-Trinitarians when someone gave them an anti-Trinitarian treatise to refute. And then in attempting to refute it, they were kind of convinced by the arguments and became anti-Trinitarians themselves. So there's this kind of anti-Trinitarian cell in Heidelberg, which is, as you'll see, it's one and the same as the anti-disciplinist cell. And so they travel, these gentlemen, Neuser and Sylvan, the two names you've heard before, Neuser and Sylvan, they travel to Speyer seeking to arrange their immigration to Transylvania, to the one territory in Europe where they could freely, you know, sort of adhere to, hold their Unitarian, anti-Trinitarian views. It didn't turn out too well for them, though. Their correspondence was seized, was given to the emperor. And boy, you want to talk about egg on everybody's face, right? This was a huge scandal, and of course it was a major embarrassment for the political leaders of the Palatinate, for everybody in the Palatinate, but particularly for the political leaders, Elector Frederick. And he said, well, you know, the emperor said, we'll see what your Calvinism, you know, has gotten us. Okay, now we have this. Okay, so then with that, this led to they had been thinking about this issue and kind of trying to come up with a compromise solution. And so when the anti-Trinitarians are discovered, that's okay, that's it. You know, we're going to settle this church discipline issue, and obviously not, for the benefit of the anti-disciplinists. And I guess I'm a little over time or about to be over time, so I should run along here. But we should say, you know, basically they construct a system of church discipline with the church discipline edict of 1570, which is a bit of a compromise solution, but it really does lean in the Calvinist direction. They establish elders there. The elders are given power to suspend people from the sacrament, but they need to, pass that information along in writing through the proper political authorities. They really, in a sense, modified the Calvinist program in some ways to make it more applicable to kind of the rural Palatine society. It wasn't easy to do, and of course that's one of the toughest things. I mean, how do you take this urban, Genevan, centralized model and apply it to the governmental structure of the Palatinate? It was very tough, but they did move in a Calvinist direction. They did adopt having excommunication, but it's still fairly closely connected, integrated with the Palatine governmental structures. Okay, since we're running out of time, I'll leave it with that. So that's in a sense, the disciplinists win the controversy, but they don't win it. You know, in a sense, it's not the slam dunk victory perhaps that they had hoped. They don't get a complete autonomous power over excommunication, but they, in a sense, they largely come out on top in the controversy. And beyond that, we should say, after 1570 into 1571, the political authorities seem to lose their really power to, or the interest perhaps, in really checking the authority of the clerics. And so whether or not it had been passed in legislation, clearly after 1570, 1571, there's a much more proactive regime. Now, some of you guys might ask, well, how would we know this or not know this? Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about it in some ways because we don't have the consistory records to fully flesh out what happened. But using other records, correspondence and things like that, we do get some sense of what was going on. Perhaps we could talk about that in the question time. Well, moving on, even though, in theory, they've kind of settled the issue of the church discipline conflict, there's still continued strife there in Heidelberg. Some of the anti-disciplinists, like Melanchthon's nephew, refuse to take part. They don't want to join the consistory. Erastus, who was kind of the chief anti-disciplinist, he's scheming a little bit to get his thesis against church discipline published abroad, even though Bullinger and Beza and the elector have all said, we're going to keep this quiet. We're going to keep this an in-house conflict. We don't really want to air our dirty laundry internationally. And then there was also continued controversy, particularly into the mid-1560s, between the church council and the university. Okay, really the church council was empowered at this point in time, and they began really to throw their weight around in Heidelberg. And then kind of the ugly side of this perhaps was the persecution of the anti-disciplinists. Some of the pastors who were identified in the anti-disciplinist side lose their positions. Obviously, the anti-Trinitarians are put on trial. Then some of the people who are only associated with the anti-disciplinists are accused of various crimes and are being anti-Trinitarians themselves, they're suspended from the sacrament, sometimes held in captivity. And then there's in 1575, there's this Pigafetta affair, which is a very complicated event where an Italian physician, Pigafetta, accuses Erastus, who was a person of really kind of unquestioned moral character and a very influential person, accuses him himself of being an anti-Trinitarian and of being kind of the head of a tremendous monster of hypocrisy in Heidelberg. And he knew all these Italian exiles who had connections to Erastus, and of course most of the religious radicals, dissenters, a lot of them were Italian, Italian radicals. Erastus had close connections to this community. Pigafetta alleged that he'd heard these things even in Erastus's sauna. Okay, so anyway, it was fairly close to the community. So Erastus himself then was suspended from communion, of course, and that's kind of a common thing in the 16th and early 17th century. If you challenge the practice of excommunication, well, you're going to get excommunicated pretty quickly yourself. It tends to prove itself out. And then this severely strain the relations between Geneva and Zurich in the mid-years of the 1570s, and particularly Heinrich Bullinger. Some of his last letters to Beza, he's just beside himself with anger and sadness over what has happened to his friends and allies in the Palatinate. However, the happy ending of the story, through long negotiations, Erastus did return to communion in 1576. So, in a sense, we have some resolution of the conflict in 1570, but then they continued to fight with one another throughout the period, all the way up until the elector himself, Elector Frederick the Third, dies. Okay, and so in a sense, they'd almost not quite kind of put aside their animosity, but then the elector dies, and in a sense it's almost like it was all for nothing, right? Because the elector dies, and then his son, Ludwig the sixth, becomes the elector, and he hates the disciplinists, right? I mean, you know, in some ways, Caspar Olivianus and Christoph Ahim are kind of public enemies number one and two. He really had a tremendous disdain for them and the sort of the influence they had had over his father. So the Reformed Confession comes a lot. I mean, the Reformed Confession briefly is eclipsed. Lutheranism returns. Okay. And we have the exodus of a number of the Reformed personnel. We're near the end here, the big finish. The Reformed Confession does survive, though. The elector had made provisions for Johann Casimir to have a sort of a state within the state that could be Calvinist reform. Oops, in the nearby, sorry about that, in the nearby city of Neustadt. Okay, we'll see if we can do that one more time. Okay, so Johann Casimir has this kind of state within a state that's Calvinist there in Neustadt. Ursinus and Zanke go there, and they lead productive careers there. Their students then later collect their works, and particularly Ursinus has a huge impact on the later development of Reformed Orthodox theology. So this becomes a key place for the survival of the Reformed Confession in the empire. Olivianus and Erastus, they continue to kind of to fight with one another. They were not reconciled when the prince dies. And so one of the first things that Erastus does when the prince dies is to more or less initiate a defense of his honor suit against Olivianus, because Olivianus had never really admitted or would never really concede that he wasn't an anti-Trinitarian. So they were still kind of very hostile to one another. Olivianus moves eventually to the Academy at Herborn and has a very distinguished career there, being one of the key sort of founders of the tradition of covenant theology, which, of course, Lyle Bierman could tell us more about. Erastus moves on to Basel after, he actually stays in the Palatinate for 4 years. They didn't force the non-theology faculty to go. And so he actually enjoys a little renaissance in Heidelberg and gets along quite well with the Lutheran elector. And there's no little Schadenfreude, you might say, in some of his letters from the time. He's, he wasn't so sad that Olivianus was gone. And then, of course, after his death, his work against the Calvinist vision of church discipline was published posthumously, that would be after his death, in London in 1589. So his anti-disciplinist ideas do live on to fight in another context, which maybe we could talk about in the questions. Dathenus, that our fiery Dutch preacher, he goes back to the Netherlands, gets himself involved in a number of controversies with William the Silent, etc. Eventually falls out, is jailed, and kind of has a complete sort of spiritual crisis, and ends his life as kind of as a spiritualist, quasi-Anabaptist, living in Prussia, of all things. So his life trajectory goes in a little different direction. Dathenus, really one of the most important organizers of the Dutch church in the 16th century. Peter Rombus, who we briefly brought into the story, unfortunately, his story is also very sad. He, shortly after he leaves Heidelberg, he meets his untimely death in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. Johann Sylvan, one of the key theologians of the anti-disciplinist faction, even though he retracted his anti-Trinitarian beliefs, was beheaded in the city square there, out in front beside the Church of the Holy Spirit in December of 1572. And then his co-conspirator, Adam Neuser, he flees once, is recaptured, and then breaks out of jail again, and perhaps has the most kind of romantic story, actually makes it all the way not only to Transylvania, but actually moves into Turkish territory, moves all the way to Istanbul, allows himself to be circumcised, okay, and then and kind of lives a life, as if he were a Muslim there in Constantinople. But then kind of continues on with a lot. He already had a reputation for drinking a little bit much before he had gone there. Dies there in 1576. But we should say his story was kind of the fodder for Lutheran sermon illustrations for the next 100 years. Right? This is the dangers of Calvinism. And because it was, you know, once again, he himself wasn't an advocate of the Calvinist disciplinary system, it was seen to be a slippery slope, right? You know, you leave Catholicism or Lutheranism, you become a Calvinist, and you're just one step away for being Unitarian. That was kind of the common route to it. And then, or an alcoholic Muslim, well, whatever. Either way, it's bad. And there were a lot of other bad things that were associated with him. Obviously not all true. But then, of course, ultimately, after Ludwig dies, the Reformed Confession does return to the Palatinate during the regency of Prince Johann Casimir. And then with that, actually, the Erastus's brother-in-law and the brother of one of the people who was excommunicated during the church disciplinary controversy, Johann Jakob Grynaeus, so someone who is very personally associated with the antidisciplinists, is the person who kind of comes back, the theologian who kind of restores the Reformed faith to the Palatinate. And so that's about all I had to say. That's the end there for more reading. So you can ask about why there was a white mountain in the background later on in the question and answers if you like. So that's our story.
So we will now have time for questions on various fronts. Yes, Franz, go ahead.
Sauna. You know, I would like. I wish I could say more about his sauna. I mean, I don't know too much about it yet. I mean, you know, as some of you. Was his hypocaustum? How would you translate that? More of a bath or
hot bath?
Hot bath? Okay. So I'm not entirely clear about what was going on there, but clear. I mean, I'm trying to work that out. You know, like so many 16th century. You know, academics, Erastus, you know, sort of what, you know, he doesn't seem to have had people living in his house, but he had a lot of boarders, you know, or people he fed and people who he arranged their care in Heidelberg. And that was a pretty big business for him. And he was a very well paid, you know, say the arts professors make about maybe 100 florin a year, and he's making, you know, 300 florin a year. And then he has all these other investments. Coming in, but in his correspondence, there's a lot of discussion of money, recovering various debts from students who'd lived with him at one time or another, and talk, you know, it was a good place to go. I mean, you know, he has kind of the upper crust, right? Polish nobles, well-heeled, bourgeois students from Basel are going to go stay with Erastus there. Okay. I wish I could say more, but I'll look into the sauna more later, I guess.
I did have a question about terminology. The use of the term disciplinist and then anti-disciplinist, isn't that in a sense a bit confusing? Because the anti-disciplinists, they weren't actually against discipline per se. They were against the idea of the church administering the discipline system. Is that right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I guess I'd like you to say a bit more about what the anti-disciplinists thought about the place of discipline in the life of a Christian in terms of how it should work, how important was it? Because I think the term anti-disciplinists almost suggests that they're advocates of a free-for-all, and that would not actually be true, correct?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I didn't come up with the terminology. I think some of this actually comes from the 16th century itself, the disciplinists' ideas. And then, of course, this is common in the literature as it's been written. I think with Erastus, though, you know, I kind of focus more, a little bit more on Ursinus here than I did Erastus. In a way, he is an anti-disciplinist because he really doesn't think that the church has much of a role to play in that. And so that's one of the reasons, he goes well beyond saying, well, you know, this Calvinist system, it's not only is it, not a good idea or not necessary. He says it's not biblical, and in fact, it's a corruption of, you know, Christianity. And so Erastus really attacks the idea of excommunication. And so that leads some of the Calvinist people like Dathenus to say, well, you know, he's an atheist, or not that he's an atheist, but his ideas are moving in an atheist direction. It's going to undermine, you know, kind of all sort of discipline and control, you know, belief in society. But, of course, they're not, you know, so they're anti-disciplinists in the church context, and that really is kind of original Erastianism. The church doesn't really have a role to play in a Christian state in discipline. But the state, you know, does, clearly. Okay. So.
So Erastus, if you asked Erastus, well, how would discipline be maintained in the church if there isn't a consistory, what would he say?
Well, he's not really that concerned about discipline in the church, you know, per se. And in some ways, he still has almost that kind of late medieval vision of, you know, sort of the church and society, you know, being one. And so that, you know, that's given to the magistrate to take care of. Yeah. It was probably about all of the above. Probably, I mean, they were very interested in which court it was going to be. But in time, they were, you know, I think with Erastus, in some ways, it's hard to separate the personal from the theoretical at some point in time. And in some way, he's at least as worried about Olivianus and his, you know, friends, his cronies, as he is the particular form of discipline. There, and I think there's another aspect of this that they think that it's not time yet. They think that, you know, once again, you know, Erastus seems to have this idea that, hey, you know, we've just adopted the Reformed faith. We really don't even have that many pastors out there in the parishes that are well trained, right, who are even on board with our program. And so if we push this disciplinary model, we're really going to be alienating the populace. Okay, so there's a bit of a kind of a strategic, that runs throughout the 1560s as well. Just, you know, and that's a long running sort of Reformation debate. You know, sort of how fast the course of the Reformation without tarrying. And there's some sense with the disciplinists, or, you know, that they really want to move fast, kind of on all fronts, and they see, you know, the discipline is the tool that they need to accomplish it. And then, when we have the anti-Trinitarians coming along, well, it's like, well, we told you we needed this, and look, and we really need now even really to control those people, and that's probably where maybe Erastus and Ursinus were maybe more on the same page there, even though they probably disagreed a bit theoretically, Erastus and Ursinus. There's clearly a vast continuum of beliefs on the question, with Erastus being kind of the most extreme rejecter, you know, of discipline, and then you go to, you know, Bullinger, Ursinus, then over toward the kind of the more fully Calvinist perspective. Anyway, I think it's both both which branch and the specific people that they were concerned about, and particularly as the conflict continues on, they were concerned about personalities. That hasn't really been, sort of fully established. That, you know, one could say that that's there's a certain parallelism, you know, of the movements, right? That in some ways, I mean, Erastus kind of comes in, and he looks at, you know, the whole tradition of Christian discipline, and he says, you know, excommunication. Hey, it's just not, it's not really in, you know, there's maybe there's discipline in the New Testament. Maybe there's, you know, excluding people from the church. But where is explicitly, you know, using exclusion from the Lord's Supper as a tool, as a, you know, as a sanction, as a penalty in the New Testament? That's, you know, kind of where Erastus comes with that. And then this also kind of reading the New Testament through, you know, Old Testament or Hebrew, the eyes of Hebrew scriptures, you know, so that's been, you know, that has been, the argument has been made that, that there is a parallelism there, and some of this kind of movement back to, you know, Old Testament models perhaps is a stimulus for the taking that next step. I guess in that way you might see kind of Erastus as the midwife of the anti-Trinitarian movement, maybe not unlike, you know, it's been alleged with Zwingli. You know, in a sense, he questions a lot of things, and he kind of leads the Anabaptists to the brink. But then he says, well, okay, but, you know, actually this baptism is okay, right? In fact, you know, and it actually agrees very well with the Old Testament practice of circumcision, where the, you know, the Anabaptists in Switzerland, you know, go the full 9 yards. Or is it the full 10 yards? Anyway, yes. Yes, that's a good question. I mean, I think in Reformation scholarship over the last, you know, in German Reformation scholarship, and so sometimes even the different branches of Reformation scholarship don't necessarily use the same lingo or kind of have the same kind of conceptions. But it was quite popular, say, within the last 30 years to talk about the Second Reformation, and with that they really mean Reformed Protestantism, Calvinism coming to the Holy Roman Empire. And so, in a sense, so the first Reformation in that vision would be the Lutheran Reformation, okay? And then we have this, you know, wave with, I mean, and the Palatinate is really the key case of a state going a step further beyond Lutheranism to the Reformed faith / Calvinism. And so that's how it's, you know, kind of used in that context. However, some of the, you know, so people like Heinz Schilling would be, you know, kind of, you know, you talk about the, you know, the Second Reformation. One of the great scholars of this period was Volker Press. I guess he died about 15 years ago. He wrote the classic study, which we have here, Calvinism, you know, so Calvinismus und Territorialstaat, about the Reformation in the Palatinate. He actually didn't like the expression Second Reformation that well because, really, if – you know, Reformed Protestantism, where was the home of Reformed Protestantism? It wasn't originally from Geneva, right? I mean, it was from Upper Germany, Strasbourg, Zurich, and it had its home really in the Southern Empire. But, of course, the Schmalkaldic War in the interim really kind of breaks that tradition. And then with the Schmalkaldic War in the interim, we have sort of Lutheranism and the Peace of Augsburg. Lutheranism really is kind of imposed in southern Germany as the official Lutheran creed, and it sort of breaks this earlier, more Zwinglian Reformed tradition in southern Germany. But with the Heidelberg Reformation, in some ways, is it a new thing? In some ways, it is a new thing with people like Olivianus and Dathenus coming to town, very much bringing in Genevan models. But it's also an old thing. There are some bureaucrats who've been around. They've been working in Strasbourg and Augsburg. They have this connection to the earlier Upper German Reformed tradition, and then they kind of bring it back to life. So Press actually kind of didn't like to think of the Heidelberg Reformation as being a second, or as we put it that way, he didn't like to think of Reformed Protestantism in Heidelberg as being a second wave, because in some ways it represented the original Reformation of southern Germany, which then in places like Württemberg and particularly Strasbourg really changes completely, right? Strasbourg was, you know, where Calvin had gone, where Martin Bucer had been, and then it really becomes sort of a hotbed of Orthodox Nazio-Lutheranism. But that's much more of an answer than you wanted there. But anyway, yeah, there is a specific, just talking about Calvinism in the Holy Roman Empire, circa 1560. And then there's then it happens later on as well when Brandenburg becomes, when the political leaders of Brandenburg become Calvinists, then we refer to that also as the Second Reformation. It's not exactly the same thing as Nader Reformatio? Sorry. Shouldn't have gone there. Oh, good. That's how things have changed. Well, I maybe I should let my friend John say it. No. that's a good question, but we're not going to be, I guess, be able to have an ecumenical understanding on those two or three points, I guess, right? I mean, you know, there's obviously so much more in the Catholic tradition in terms of, you know, the teaching authority of the church that would have to be embraced. So I don't know. I guess we'd have to design our ecumenical overtures maybe on a little different path. Does anyone else have a suggestion or a better answer for that?
The Pope is coming here, so maybe we can catch him.
Okay, we can ask him. I'm sure he'll have a better idea than I do. Thanks for the question.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for your participation. And please join me again in thanking our speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was great.